Mud Angels, 1966-68. Autumn rolled round again and brought shorter days and early nights and 6 weeks of continuous rain due to a cyclone over the Mediterranean. Northern Italy was awash. Beginning of November, and Ulysses looked out from his workshop at the deluge. He could feel the damp rising up from the ground. It was nearly dusk, and the square was bleak and torn of life. The following day was a holiday, when the city celebrated the country's victory over Austria in the First World War. People had already left for the weekend, and Alice had driven Crest to Rome on account of the old fellow's keen interest in the romantic poets. There were no guests at the pensione, so Ulysses was alone for the first time in years, a queasy proposition. He'd arranged to meet Massimo later that evening, a British industry gathering, something to do with the swinging 60s in London. The rain was making the prospect of a night out unappealing. The 50-centimetre diameter globe in front of him was his best yet. It was sold already to a family whose lineage went back a few centuries, not an uncommon occurrence in a city such as this. He was adding minor details, that was all now. Brush in one hand, rag in the other. Paint dab, careful not to overwork it. The stand was being made by a carpenter nearby, a freestanding base made of oak, with a brass meridian. It would break his heart to let it go. He stubbed out his cigarette and decided to call it a day. He opened the door and emptied the hot coals from the scaldini into the gutter. Then put on his hat and mac and turned off the lights. The sound was of rain only. Coming out onto Via Maggio, the smells and lustre of the Alimentari drew him in. He loaded himself up with cheese and meat and pasta and 2 special bottles of wine, and by the time he got to the square, he was soaked. He showered long, lay on the bed and listened to the drum of rain against the shutters. The red neon sign from Michele's pulsed across the dark, and the Beach Boys sang, "Don't worry, baby," faintly from the jukebox. If it was anyone but Massimo, he would have cancelled. It was the kind of night to settle on the sofa with a grappa and a large parrot for company. He put on a suit, loosely knotted a dark tie and discarded shoes in favour of Wellington boots. He grabbed an umbrella and headed out into the storm-lashed night. Along Lungarno Guicciardini, thunder rumbled across the hills. The streets were inundated and cascades of water were thrown up by passing taxis and packed buses. Black umbrellas clogged the narrow pavements, and the green, white and red bunting, hastily erected for the following day's holiday, was drenched. But it was the river whose transformation was most startling. The grassy flatlands where the fishermen stood had been swallowed by the swollen current. Crossing Santa Trinita Bridge, the water raged through the stone arches only a few feet below. How could such a softly spoken green stream have turned into this? Massimo was waiting for him outside Palazzo Strozzi, and after commenting on his sartorial elegance, "And why not Wellington boots, Ulysses?" he said that he had already been up to the gathering, and it was incredibly dull, although the wine, as you'd expect, was good. "So, I suggest we go eat." The suggestion was Zia Chiara, tucked behind Piazza Santa Croce. It was a small restaurant that was really a domestic front room, with 3 tables of 2 only and no menu. You ate whatever Zia Chiara had made that evening for her family upstairs. Ulysses knew the food to be superb, the evening finally on an upswing. The wind had subsided, and the journey east was made at a fair trot. They arrived at Zia Chiara's door relatively dry and in good spirits. The walls carried photographs, some sepia, some faded, of farm life before the families moved to the urban north. A crucifix too, of course, and a signed photograph from a beloved film star. Zia Chiara, nobody does it better, Sophia Loren. They sat next to a cat, who, seemingly indifferent to the nightly incursion on its home, washed itself thoroughly before settling on Massimo's lap. A jug of red wine and a basket of pane casalingo were placed on the table, and for an hour Chiara forgot about them. The conversation turned immediately to Alice and Cress's pilgrimage to Rome. Ulysses said that Cress wanted to see where the poet Keats had died, said it would help him get a sense of the city through a 25-year-old's eyes. I was engaged when I was 25, said Massimo.
You were?
To Annunziata Berlingo. After I broke it off, she married a Frescobaldi.
That's quite a rebound.
He wasn't the main branch, a mere twig.
You think they'll get to the Cinecittà Studios?
If Alice has her way.
Any souvenir would be appreciated.
Ulysses laughed. She knows that. Massimo poured out the wine and said, My mother has an admirer, by the way.
Your mother does.
I know, I know. We placed her in the home for safety. She's like a teenager, very amorous. But what can you do? By the time the beef came out, the men had made good progress on the wine, and the weather outside a thing of the past.
Rain? What rain? Said Massimo.
At some point, Ulysses thought to mention the height and force of the river. Massimo said it was probably the snowmelt from Monte Falterona, or maybe they opened the gates on the dams to release the pressure. Massimo stood up.
Talking of releasing the pressure, he said, and the signora pointed to the back.
They paid the bill and wished one another a happy festa, and the two men left the old woman in a chair resting her eyes, the older brother shuffling down the stairs in search of a sliver of cheese. Piazza Santa Croce was quiet. A few parked cars, but no wanderers that night. At the corner of Via de' Benci, they clasped one another and arranged to meet on Saturday for a rerun of 8.5 at the Rex. Massimo went north, Ulysses south, the river loud as he approached. He crossed at the Ponte Vecchio. The bridge was shaking beneath his feet, the Arno grinding against the old stones that Taddeo Gaddi had laid in 1345, throwing up water against the parapet. The moon waning gibbous, cloaked by clouds amongst a starless night. By the Palazzo Pitti, the city was empty. Ulysses cut through Via dello Sprone into Piazza dei Sapiti and noticed water bubbling out from the narrow slits along the gutters. He threw a glance at his workshop, at the globe suspended in the darkness, vulnerable and pure. Cress said he'd captured the essence of the planet itself. Entering Piazza Santo Spirito, all was calm. The shutters on the buildings were closed as you'd expect, the odd light or two, but he knew who the insomniacs were. Water was coming up from the gutters here too. He entered his building, but didn't go up straight away. It was that niggle in his guts that made him head for the cellar. He stepped down the stone stairs into ankle-deep water, and a strong stink of drains was no surprise. The overhead light flickered, but didn't go out. The topmost bags of coal were still dry, and they were the first to come up, and the boxes the elderly Contessa had asked him to store. Crates of cheese and wine for the pensione came next, jars of homemade passata, bottles of oil, bottles of San Pellegrino mineral water, anything unadulterated, anything he could wipe free of water, all brought up to the ground floor. And every time he went back down, he had a sense the water was rising. The bike came up last, wheels dripping. He was wired and exhausted, and his best suit was drenched. And at 2 a.m., he went over to Michele's. Michele, out of the top floor window,
Hey, soldato, what time you call this?
It's the cellars, Michele. It's always the fucking cellars.
But Michele came down. His night would be long. Ulysses put on a pot of coffee and changed his clothes. He moved about with a sense of dread and thought at first that it was about Alice and Cressy. He went out onto the terrace for air. The rain had softened to a drizzle and the city was trapped under a haze both torpid and eerie. Dawn was still 5 hours away. What is it? He wondered. The restlessness felt like wartime, the unseen enemy in wait. He wouldn't sleep, he knew that. He finished the last of his coffee and decided to set about the task of bringing up the coal and the crates and sacks. It seemed the most sensible thing to do. He grabbed a torch and went out into the stairwell. At 4:30 a.m., the elderly Contessa opened her door.
You stealing my things now, Signor Temper?
The cellars flooded Contessa, and he placed the last of the boxes at her feet. Take 'em or leave 'em, he said. He was in no mood for her rancor.
Grazie,
But he was gone. He closed the wooden door quietly behind him and stepped out into the night. Lights were on in Michele's, and he could see the big man at the counter having an espresso. He turned left into Via Maggio, torchlight leading him down to the river. He heard it before he'd even got close. The sound was deafening. A terrifying black torrent, almost level with the top of the parapets, was frothing and howling and pitching foam into the wind. Suddenly, a mighty oak dragged down from the Casentino slammed against the wall in front of him, sending up clouds of spindrift. He stumbled to the ground, heart pounding at this mad confrontation with nature. The torch went out. He stood up. The river was now cascading over the top of the embankment wall, and black waves were eddying and turning back on themselves. He hit the torch against his leg, and a beam of light shot out against the bricks. Small cracks had begun to appear, spurting water. He turned and ran. Borgo San Jacopo, already inundated as he passed, the wail of a siren, ominous in the distance. Michele was in the bar, talking to a group of men, and before Ulysses could tell them what he'd seen, Michele called out to him,
Everything's going down, soldato. Electricity, telephones. You need to collect as much water as possible before the pressure gives out.
Ulysses entered the hallway and ran the stairs two at a time. He knocked on the Contessa's door.
You again, she said.
Contessa, fill every container you have with water. The bath, bowls, anything.
You frighten me, Signor Tempa.
Don't be frightened. Just do it, Contessa.
What's happening?
I don't know. Back inside, he lifted the phone to warn Massimo, but the line was dead. Bath, pots, saucepans, anything capable of containing water was filled, and he went down and did the same in the pensione. Back down the stairs once more, but this time out of the front door. A helicopter swooped overhead, his torchlight cutting a path through the inundated streets. By the time he got to Piazza dei Sapiti, it was already 2 feet underwater. A beam of light through the window showed sheets of paper and plastic molds shimmering on the undulating black surface. The wooden door had swollen, and it took his shoulder to get it open. Inside, the smell of paint and sewers and water rising by the minute. The rain had stalled, and he needed to take the globe now. He stuck the torch in his pocket, lifted the giant sphere, and began to back out of the doorway. Only then did he notice the three bundles of his father's copper plates on an upper shelf. Fuck. It was simply too late. Darkness all about him, an occasional whisper of moon. His boots were waterlogged, heavy as stone, legs fighting against the current. Water waist height now. He lifted the globe higher still, grateful for the halt in rain which would have destroyed it. Out onto Via Maggio, and the water pulled like mud. Flash! He turned. Click. Caught forever. The photographer raised his hand and waded off towards the Palazzo Pitti. Ulysses turned right. The street drew colour from the lightning hour, and the undulation of the ground made the water shallower, and his footing felt firmer. He was in the square. He was almost there, and his arms burned from the carry, but home was up ahead, the globe achingly beautiful in the violet light of morning. Michele shouting to him from the top window, Ulysses looked up and nodded. Suddenly, a fierce brown surge rose behind him and threw him into the deluge. He felt the moment the globe was ripped from his hands, the impact as he was slammed into the fountain, the roaring in his ears. He gripped the ledge with the last of his strength as the water rushed past him into Via San Agostino. But it was too much, and eventually he had to let go, carried across the square to the statue, where he came to rest. When the water settled and shallowed out, he stood up. He looked about, but the globe was gone. He just about had time to get into his building and close the door before another frothing surge rolled across the square. He sat on the stairs, dazed, breathless, shaking. The Contessa above calling out to him. The slow climb up. By noon, Mayor Bargellini had got to a radio mic and announced to the city that the water had arrived in Piazza del Duomo, and in some neighborhoods it had reached the second floor of buildings. He told everyone to remain calm and told those with boats and canoes to bring them to the Palazzo Vecchio. Shortly after Ulysses had changed clothes, there was a knock at the door. The elderly Contessa must have listened to the radio announcement too, because she stood in the doorway and said,
"Signor Temper, I have no electricity, no lights, I have no gas, I am cold, and I have no water, and now the idiota talks of floods. Why didn't he stop it?"
Ulysses invited her inside and sat her beside the coal stove.
"I had coal once," she said, "but they made me have gas, and now I have nothing."
It was a simple lunch of spaghetti and passata, and she followed his every move about the kitchen. He threw in a couple of leftover sausages and a handful of black olives, a pinch of chili. He opened one of the good bottles of wine, and she said,
"Very nice indeed."
From the transistor radio, a broadcast warned that the city water was polluted.
"For how long?" said the Contessa.
He drained the pasta, but kept the salted water for the toilet.
"Why the toilet?" said the Contessa.
"Because you can't flush 'em," he said.
"Oh, mio Dio, it was just like the war."
They ate and said little after that. When she'd finished, the Contessa complimented him on his cooking.
"A little more salt, maybe," she said.
"Maybe," he said. He put the coffee pot on the stove. The Contessa said,
"That's the best type of coffee pot. It never lets you down. Not like the mayor," she said.
Ulysses took his coffee onto the terrace with Claude. The fountain had become its own island, and you'd need a boat to get to church now. Before light faded, the water ran putrid with a shimmering yellow scum, and there was a high stench of oil. Red gasoline cans bobbed on the surface, such an incongruous trespass of colour. The car swept into the square and clattered against the metal shutters of the tabacchi. All about, the narrow streets were awash, the cortile below immersed. All those workshops, all those livelihoods, all those ground floor magicians who made shoes wearable and mended chairs and carved wonder and made frames of gold. Paintings began to float in on the tide, an antique shop or gallery broken into by the onslaught. A quick glimpse of a cherubim before the canvas sank. By 5 p.m., the city was in blackout. Ulysses and the Contessa sat by the stove and listened to the Italian news broadcast by candlelight. All Tuscany had suffered flooding. Florence was cut off by road, rail, and telephone from Rome in the south to Bologna in the north.
"Someone needs to go down and check on the place," said the Contessa. "But I have the wrong shoes."
Ulysses switched on the torch and went down through the stairwell. He entered the pensione and opened the dresser where Cress kept boxes of candles. He didn't go back up straight away, kept going down the stairs till he hit the waterline. 3-4 feet, maybe. Far below the Contessa's landing, he could at least give her that reassurance. He sat on the stone. The heady smell of petroleum and sewage, the sound of debris battering against the front doors like the heaving clang of a ship slowly sinking. He thought about Massimo, but knew Massimo lived up high. Wondered when Cress and Alice would get back home. He needed to know everyone was safe because without them, he was nothing. The torch flickered. He banged it against his hand and a faint beam skimmed the surface. A carp darted away from the intrusion, and the water rose. Night stayed black. No stars, but faint spirals of smoke. Helicopters cast light across darkened rooftops, the rhythmic chug of rotor blades against the air. Ulysses held the umbrella above the Contessa while she looked through the telescope. She said she was scared during the war.
"Scared like this," she said.
She said not many people had liked Arturo Bernardini, but she had. She said he was a man worth saving,
She said she'd watched Ulysses climb onto the roof all those years ago. She thought he was brave. Strange, but brave.
And you were so young. I think the helicopters are rescuing people from the rooftops, she added. Maybe they need you over there, too.
They camped out in the salotto. A candelabra, a bottle of grappa close to an elderly woman's hand, and a parrot singing show tunes.
Does he often do that? Said the Contessa.
Ulysses shrugged.
What's that noise?
Said the Contessa. Where?
Out there, she said, pointing.
Ulysses got up and opened the shutters. Michele at his window with a candle. Names were being shouted across the square.
Signor, Signora Bruni, he called out. Signor Carai.
The flicker of lights appeared in the darkness.
Si, qui. Are you all right, Signora Buonarroti?
Si, si.
Signor Conti?
Si, qui.
Another candle.
Signora Moretti?
One by one, candles appeared at the windows, human stars across a watery night. And then Ulysses heard it. Not soldato this time, nor signor Tempa, but Ulysses. He raised his candle and shouted, I'm here. I'm well. He said that the Contessa was with him, that she too was well. A sudden cry across the square.
I'm Signor Lami, and I have no candles.
Where are you, signore?
West side, top floor, five along from Michele. Wave something white,
shouted Ulysses, and he waited.
I see you,
shouted Ulysses.
Open both windows, signore, and keep waving.
Ulysses turned to Claude. Here, Claudie, and he picked him up. Over there, he said. You see the white in the window? Follow my finger, Claude. Just there. Claude squawked. Good boy. Ulysses grabbed a candle from the box and held it in front of him. This needs to go over there, he said. Think you can do it, Claude? By now, the Contessa was following events avidly.
Che straordinario, she kept saying. Che straordinario.
Think you can, Claude? Claude squawked. Ulysses placed the candle carefully in the parrot's beak and positioned him out of the window. Over there, he whispered. Straight over.
Keep waving, Signor Lami, he shouted, and stand back when you see the parrot.
Go, Claude, go. Whoosh. A flash of blue and yellow in the gloom, and what a sight he was. The weight of the candle caused a sudden drop in altitude, and there was a sharp intake of breath from the Contessa as Claude's chest feathers skimmed the black lake. But then he rose. Oh, how magnificently he rose. He circled the square twice until the flight path had been worked out and the landing zone calculated. 10 feet, 9 feet, straighten, straighten, decrease speed.
You can do it,
whispered Ulysses.
You can do it,
whispered the Contessa. Ulysses shouted to Signor Lami to stand back, and suddenly Claude disappeared through the open window. There was a sound of broken glass. Anxious seconds passed.
You sure the man opened the window? Said the Contessa.
He had. It was simply that he was surprised by the appearance of so large a parrot that he dropped a wine bottle.
Look! Shouted the elderly Contessa. He did it!
And he had. Where previously darkness had reigned was now light. Claude launched back out into the sky. He flew high as the Campanile, and he glided on the still point, the rush of air a silent and ancient sound heard first inside his egg. The calling to break free. The splintering of the shell, that first indescribable gulp of air. Oh, what it was to fly! He perched on the head of Cosimo R, adrift in the Arno Sea, where he would remain witness to the night, watching over his people till land appeared again out of the primordial vortex that once had birthed life itself. They may even erect a statue of him. Now, wouldn't that be something? 10 p.m. news broadcast. Florence is a lake. 10 feet of water in the Piazza del Duomo. Families calling out from second-floor windows. All afternoon, helicopters have been rescuing stranded people from rooftops. Women and children only, men left on the roofs. Pisa has taken the full force of the deluge across its plain and has asked Florence for help. Florence can't even help herself. Ulysses turned off the radio. The Contessa said,
"We have a long night ahead of us."
At this point, Ulysses realized the woman had no intention of going home. He said, "You can stay here if you wish, Contessa."
"I'd like that, Signor Tempa. Guest room, of course."
And before she fell asleep, she said someone needed to stay awake, just in case. Ulysses promised he'd stand guard all night. At midnight, he left the door on the latch and went down the stairs. Torchlight showed the water was lowering, and he knew they'd got off lightly, 10 feet in the Duomo Square. In his bedroom, he opened the shutters. The rain had stopped. He lay down and fell asleep immediately. 7 a.m. brought a flaming sunrise, the beautiful sound of the swoosh of car tires. He got up and looked out at the devastation. A Madonna stood muddied in the middle of the square. Her broken hand pointed to the sky. One by one, on the morning of the 5th of November, people emerged from doorways, dazed by the horror that awaited them. The water had gone, but had left behind the unimaginable, a thick layer of black, stinking mud that coated everything, a slick composition of heating oil, soil, and sewage. A wafty waft that marked buildings at the highest point of the river's reach, an inconsistent line that would rise and fall throughout the city streets. Metal shutters on shops and restaurants had either buckled or been ripped away, and the interiors destroyed. Two cars had overturned near the fountain, and at the doors of the basilica, Cressy's Moto Guzzi Falcone was lying on its side. The stone benches, holders of memory, had become holders of muck. Flagstones had been torn up, windows smashed, and out into the mire had been sucked the intimate and the everyday. Shoes from the cobbler were strewn about the black landscape, giving the impression that scattered corpses lay not far beneath. This was not life that would ever return to normal. Anything that could not be salvaged from ground floor homes or shops or cafes began to appear in the square. A pram, an accordion, cushions, a toy car, tins of food, chairs, clothing, radios, a television set, suitcases, paintings, letters. It broke your heart, but you had to do it. You had to place it on the pile with all the rest, even if it was a jukebox. Michele was trying unsuccessfully to maneuver the machine out of the bar. He looked up at Ulysses' approach.
"Che disastro," he said.
Ulysses grabbed a corner and helped shift the machine into the square. Inside the bar, the watermark stood at just over a meter. Bottles of alcohol on the higher shelves, the public telephone and the ancient coffee machine that had travelled up from the south were the only things untouched by the mud. Ulysses picked up chairs and carried them out and placed them on the pile. Julia hovered by the kitchen.
"I will do this only once, Ulysses," she said, tears falling.
He followed her down into the kitchen where the tide mark rose, everything covered by shit, the smell noxious and potent.
"Where do we start?" she cried. "Tell me where. No water even to clean."
And Ulysses wanted to hold her, but Michele moved past and said something harsh about her tears.
"Ulysses," he said, "help me. We take it all out, icebox first."
Massimo found Ulysses in the square. The two men held one another till 100 silent words had passed between them. "How's it your side?" said Ulysses. "So bad." And Massimo recounted what he'd seen and heard. Embankments had been washed away. The Biblioteca Nazionale was still completely cut off by water and inundated. Santa Croce, no one can get inside. Street after street of overturned cars and dead cattle. The baptistry doors have been ripped from their frames. The mayor and the film crew are over there now, and panels from the gates of paradise are missing. "Madonna mia," whispered Julia, and went back inside the bar. "No one knows how many are dead," he said. The men looked up at a helicopter. "You hear they released all the prisoners from the Marate," said Michele, "and now the looting starts." Ulysses went across to help Julia carry out a table. "You been to your workshop, Ulysses?"
"Not yet."
Michele turned.
"You do this, but you haven't been there? Take him now, Signor Buontalenti."
The pavements were slippery with stinking mud, the fango, and each step was slow and perilous. People were out in the streets starting the clear-up. "Worse than the war," they said. Faces hardened, the swish of brooms, the scrape of wooden rakes. "An impossible task without detergents and water, but we have to do something," they say. The cheese seller, fishmonger, butcher, all gone. The contents festering in the road. Haberdashery shop, toy shop, bike shop, gone, gone, gone. When they got to Piazza dei Sapiti, the narrow streets had funneled the water with such velocity that the small square had taken the full force. The door to Ulysses' workshop was ajar, and inside the walls were blackened. Globes, once the prize of the upper shelves, had been sucked into the eddy. Old map books that he'd collected since arriving in the city. Desi's moulds, tools, his father's plates. Outside, a woman wailing, "I've lost everything. I've lost everything." Ulysses felt dizzy. The place stank. The woman's voice rising with panic. "Ulysses?" said Massimo. Ulysses felt Massimo's hand on his back. He reached into his jacket for cigarettes. "Not here," said Massimo gently. "It's all oil, Ulysses." Ulysses staggered out and threw up. Down by the river, they walked with silent groups of Florentines. The water had dropped 15 feet, but still raced towards the sea. On the Ponte Vecchio, tree trunks stuck out in all directions. Great swathes of leaves and branches clung like giant nests. The goldsmith and jewellery shops had been ransacked, and the owners left scavenging in the mud for a glint of anything worthwhile. The waterfront outside the library had been torn away, and vast banks of mud blocked the entrance. On the north side came the first sighting of boats and canoes being poled along. Buckets lowered from upper windows to collect food, water, anything to make the hours ahead bearable. The two men were forced to backtrack. Another street revealed blackened mattresses and clothing drying and hardening in the sun and wind. A pet shop full of caged, drowned songbirds.
"La fine del mondo," said a man.
"The end of the world." In Santa Croce Square, they stood where they'd been only two nights before. Cars were stacked on top of one another, half in water, half in mud, and the tide mark clear on Dante's statue. 20 feet, was it? Unthinkable. Here, mostly the poor and elderly were housed, in basements or ground floors. "Come on," said Massimo, and they slipped and clambered across the stinking wasteland, holding on to each other for balance. But every attempt to get close to Zia Chiara's restaurant failed. Street after street underwater, and the carabinieri forced them back, saying foundations were unsafe and walls were about to come down. Massimo shouted to a man if he knew where Zia Chiara and her brothers had gone, but the man shrugged. No one knew anything, it seemed. No one knew even how they would eat that day. Light faded by 4, and the clean-up stopped. Ulysses and Massimo dumped boots and muddied clothing on the upper floor landing. They washed on the terrace with a bowl of rainwater and left the dregs by the toilet cistern. A little after six, a knock at the door.
Not too early, am I?
Said the elderly Contessa. They ate the last of the cold meats and spaghetti with oil and garlic and chili. The Contessa complimented Massimo on the balance of flavour he'd achieved.
A little more peperoncino, perhaps?
Perhaps, he said. Ulysses got up and put the coffee pot on the stove. The night air was frosty and carried the wail of fire crews and the ambulances of the Misericordia. The Contessa said that Rome had washed its hands of the city, and in a remarkable volte-face said that Mayor Bargellini was the only one who cared. And the Casa del Popolo, said Ulysses.
What do you know about those communists? She said.
I know they're giving out food and medicine.
And don't forget the bakers in Fiesole, said Massimo. They've been getting bread to the poor.
Yes, well, bakers are good people, she said. A baker I'd trust with my kidneys. But where are the bulldozers? Where's the army? Rome thinks we can clear a landslide with a spoon.
The Contessa finished her coffee and declared she was tired. She took Ulysses' arm and he led her down to her apartment. In the short time it took for Ulysses to return, Massimo had fallen asleep on the sofa. A dogged exhaustion clung to everything. He covered Massimo with blankets and closed the shutters. Ulysses lay in bed. His tiredness had now passed. Slow hours ahead, listening to the despair of a city, cold and forsaken and entombed in mud. Maybe people don't know, he thought. Maybe no one really knows how much help we need. But they did. The world was listening. And long before his thoughts had settled, volunteers from around the world were mobilizing. Experts in art restoration and hundreds of students with the intrinsic belief they could change the world. Even a man from Manchester, whose memories of lovemaking in a Renaissance palazzo made him tingle. Des leant across the table and turned off the radio.
I need to do something, Poppy.
I know you do, Des. You're that kind of man.
I'm going to drive down to Tuscany in a Land Rover. Take a few essentials, show I care. You coming?
Not this time, Des.
They were awaiting their first grandchild.
But why not go to London and take Piano Pete? You've been longing to meet him.
Great idea, said Des. I reckon I could start out in a couple of days.
You need a Land Rover, Des.
I'll buy one.
And in Bristol, Jem Gunnerslake, now 30 and studying medicine, as Evelyn Skinner had once predicted, put down his copy of The Observer and phoned his university to say he needed 10 days off to deal with a family crisis. He jumped on the train with galoshes, a K-way rain jacket, and one change of clothing. He looked out from the ferry as England pulled away. He was going to Florence to save art. He was a 60s man through and through, and peace and love pulsed through his pulmonic and aortic valves, and he smiled wide now that his teeth were fixed. Ulysses woke to a day of firsts. First trucks brought water into the city, for cleaning and not for drinking, but that was something. And the first wave of young people gathered outside the Biblioteca and formed a human chain to clear the mud from the entrance. And the first of the telegrams started to get through, and Ulysses received one from Rome. It had been sent the day before and was handed to him as he was shoveling mud out of the cortile. Roads impassable. We'll try again tomorrow. Home soon. Love you. The tears came then. He turned away from the group because he couldn't stop. That afternoon, having kept close behind a bus chartered by the Grotta Ferrata monks, Betsy rolled into Santo Spirito Square, mudded and worse for wear. Alice, close to the windscreen, tried to absorb the broken lives in front of her. Ulysses saw them first and, oh, the look on his face, the look on hers, click, caught forever. He'd been standing outside the cafe with Michele and Julia and the elderly Contessa, who said,
"About time. I hope they've brought food."
Of course they had. Wine and water too. And it would be the first time in days that anyone would eat eggs or bread or drink milk. Alice climbed out of the van and Ulysses went towards her. Arms around him, she said, if anything had happened to you.
What's that jukebox doing over there, Michele?
Said Cress.
You bring it in for the cold and I'll have it cleaned up and fixed in no time.
Julia said, can you do the same for my heart, Signor Cress?
Alice was waiting at the rail station. She was muddied from head to toe and wearing jeans, jumper, smock. Hair up, sunglasses, and a cigarette in her mouth. Massimo called her the epitome of cool, elongating the double vowel, of course. It was the third time in as many days that she'd been there, and despite the afternoon cold, she liked it. Direct connection to the outside world, what with trains coming and going, and newspapers and a chance to stock up on cigarettes. Standing above the height of the flood, the place retained an air of normalcy, if you could ignore the mud-streaked floors, that is, and the posters telling people to boil all water due to the latent danger of typhoid and cholera. A stink of diesel streamed out from the generator, keeping the telegram office alight. Alice lit a cigarette and watched a train pull in. Hundreds of students were arriving daily, and the city was finding it hard to house them. Youth hostels and dormitories were overflowing, and the empty sleeping cars and coaches in the rail yard had now been commandeered. Cress and Ulysses had agreed to open up the pensione for whoever needed a place to stay, and so far it was working well. Some of the kids had even taken it upon themselves to help Michele and Julia clean out the bar. Alice watched a young woman pass in front of her. Made it quite obvious she couldn't take her eyes off her. It was easy to flirt when you had rooms to offer. The woman ran on ahead, though, and put her arm around a man. Ah, well, win some, lose some. And Alice inhaled on her cigarette. And then she noticed him. A bit lost, a bit older than the rest. Nice smile.
Excuse me,
she said, running up to him. He stopped.
Me? Have you come to clean up?
I have, actually.
Do you need somewhere to stay?
Yes, I suppose I do, really.
I'm Alice,
and she offered her hand.
Jem.
Jem Gunnerslake.
Follow me, Jem.
And they left the station concourse, down the steps to the mud-covered square. Tarred cars and huge piles of detritus gathering outside, the watermark at 6 feet.
Jesus, said Jem.
Careful where you tread, said Alice. You can't see, but a lot of the paving stones are up.
Was it worse than this?
Hard to say. Down by the river it's as bad as ever. In Santa Croce, Gavinana, San Nicolo. Cellars are still flooded because there's not enough pumps. And you'll see thousands of cars like that. They've got the army shoveling this shit, but apart from that, there's not much that will make a difference right now.
Jem rubbed his nose.
Chlorine. I'm getting used to it. They covered the city with it. I saw the posters. Vaccination centres are open now. You need one, Jem.
I'm fine.
And he patted his arm. Walking across Santa Maria Novella Square, Alice said, and she pointed to the church, if you need candles, you can buy them off a priest over there for 100 lire apiece.
Do I need some?
Not for now. We have plenty. But they're always welcome.
And if I want to make a telephone call?
No chance.
Telegrams are okay.
International go through the central post office. Be prepared to queue for hours, though. We have no lights, no heating, no water at the moment. We flush the toilet with a bucket twice a day, when we all leave for work and when we go to sleep. Unless it's really necessary, you know.
Righto.
You'll get a towel and a bowl of cold water morning and night to wash in. All muddy clothes and boots left outside on the landings. Bread and jam for breakfast. Tea mostly, sometimes coffee if we can get it. Milk sometimes, if you can get it, she smiled. A bowl of pasta at night. There's also a canteen in the Academia, if you'd prefer to eat there. Just let us know in the morning, though. You may have a room to yourself one night, or you may have to bunk in with others. That make you squeamish?
Autopsies make me squeamish.
Alice laughed.
Left here, she said.
I'm giving you the tourist walking tour.
How much? Said Jem.
For the tour?
For the room, he said.
Nothing, Jem Gunnerslake. This is the city's gift to you, in lieu of the hundreds of back-breaking hours you'll do.
How does it work? He said.
And he slipped, trying to catch up with her.
I mean, how do I start work? Do I just turn up? You could, but there's an office at the Uffizi that sends you where you're needed. And where's that, usually? Depends. Could be a hospital. Duomo straight ahead, Jem Gunnerslake. Or getting food to the elderly. Mostly it's the Biblioteca right now, though. It's pretty gruesome inside. 22 feet of mud in the lower floors and waist-deep water. That's where the books are. No generators, just torchlight and candles to work by. There are hundreds of us in there, Jem, passing buckets of mud or books to each other. Mud goes outside, books upstairs to rinse off and dry out. And then what? Then they're taken to the Forte Belvedere for the start of restoration. Right. Sculpture goes to Palazzo Davanzati, canvas paintings to the Accademia, and panel paintings are sent to the Limonaio in the Palazzo Pitti. To date, 18 churches and 15 museums devastated. You know a lot. You get to know a lot. Everyone you work with has been somewhere else. I actually spent my first day at the Uffizi, cleaning masterpieces. No, those had been moved, thank God. They trusted us only with the ones deemed insignificant. How insignificant? Woman next to me uncovered a Velázquez. No way! Gallery didn't even know it was in the basement. That's the trouble with this city, Jem. No one knows where anything is. That night in the pensione, the upper landings and handrails were strewn with mud-caked clothes and boots. Inside, the hallway was a jumble of coats and jumpers and scarves. The bedrooms like dorms. Double beds were now single beds and camp beds made three. The bathroom floor was streaked with mud, and someone had left the radio on, and it crackled with static and occasionally a tune. On the upper floor, the coal stove cranked out heat and steam, and the dining table was set. This is Jem, everyone. That's Alicia, Tom, Aldo, James, Carol. Jem nodding. Hello, hello, he said, but he'd never remember their names. Too nervous. Alice said, you sit by me, Jem. Thanks, said Jem. At 7, Ulysses and Cress carried in bowls of pasta and bread and salad. Always a cheer when they entered, and you should have seen the look on Cress's face. Big fuss of Cressy every time. 5 minutes later, there was a knock at the door.
Not too early, am I?
The elderly Contessa entered and added,
you're all still here, then?
Nice fur, said a young woman called Neve.
I killed it myself, said the Contessa.
By 10 o'clock, the candles had burnt low amongst the debris of dinner. Students, tired and blush-cheeked, sprawled on chairs and sofas and floors, wrapping scarves tighter around their necks. Cigarettes smouldered in ashtrays, raised to mouths during the telling of tales. The last of the wine was drunk. On the terrace, a kerosene lamp flickered, a clothesline pegged with towels and cloths and rags, and Ulysses, Cress, and the elderly Contessa huddled against the frieze. The conversation from inside drifted out into the untroubled air. Cress said,
the young have brought something intrinsic to the city. Crabs, said the elderly Contessa. I was thinking energy and hope, said Cress.
Overheard. What do you do, Jem? Studying medicine. Will you take a look at my foot? Laughter. What? It's been hurting for days. I bet you get asked that all the time, Jem. Not all the time, and I'd be happy to have a look, although I'm specialising in gynaecology. Laughter. Alice strummed her guitar, and the conversation stopped. Familiar opening bars to what would become the anthem of that time, God Only Knows, sang over and over, voices parading across the star-packed night. And don't tell me that didn't bring a little catch to the throat of those listening. Soldiers patrolling the streets, the insomniacs and restless hearts tossing prayers in the air. A pure melody lifted by the haunting glare of a kerosene lamp. Pete would have said, life don't get much better. The next morning was bitterly cold. The kids left early for the waterfront, and Ulysses and Cress made a start on the stone benches. So far, so normal. Then all of a sudden, into this routine, sped a spanking new Land Rover packed to the hilt.
Well, I'll be, said Cress.
And even Claude flew down from the statue of Cosimo R to have a peek. The Land Rover skidded to a halt. Des clambered out from behind the wheel and adjusted his driving gloves.
Des, said Ulysses and Cress. Hello, lad. Hello, me old friend Cress. Must have done 100 all the way. And Pete, how on earth did you two...
Long story, said Des. Pete fell into Ulysses' arms.
Oh, it was a lovely journey, Temps. No drama at all.
What are you both doing here? Said Ulysses.
We're the Coordinated Disaster Relief Team, said Des. You can't rely on that president in Rome.
Des met him at conference once, interrupted Pete.
Right, Tosser, said Des. So here we are.
And he moved to the back of the vehicle and flung open the doors.
I've got manual bilge pumps, gas masks, wet weather gear, Wellington boots, waders, kerosene lamps, candles, blankets, woolen socks, transistor radios and batteries, moisturiser for the ladies, powdered milk, cream for foot rot, bleach, sponges, shovels, brooms. What else, Pete?
TCP, he said.
Gallons of TCP, said Des. First aid kits and as much food and mineral water as we could get our hands on. Right, Pete?
Pete gave him a thumbs up. Pete had never looked happier. I feel bad that we couldn't have got the vaccines, though, said Des quietly.
What vaccines? Said Ulysses.
Typhoid and tetanus, whispered Des.
Contact was arrested at the border.
Sorry to hear that, Des.
Right then, Ulysses, lad. Any chance of a... coffee with a touch of grappa?
My kind of man, said Des.
Lead the way, comrade.
Pete bunked in with Ulysses, and Des got the guest room to himself.
I like the new touches, he said to Cress. Ceramics are definitely the way to go.
Afterwards, they each took it in turns to pump out the cellar.
These waders have already paid for themselves, said Des.
And Cress made a start on the jukebox, now that he had proper industrial cleaning fluid. And across the river, Alice and Jem descended the stairs of the library, down into the murky underworld where the air was poisonous and gas masks were worn. The water had gone, but the mud about them was still boot height and frozen. They stopped at their allocated positions, and Alice gave Jem a thumbs up. The first bucket came through, and the next at a cracking pace. A book now blackened by sludge, book after book after book, the written patrimony of Western civilization. And sometimes through the mud, a glimmer of gold or a glimmer of blue stilled their breath, made them humble, that shy glimpse of ancient holy.
Bloody hell, said Des.
Jesus, Temps, said Pete. It was 2 days later, and the men were in Piazza dei Sapiti, where the rotting debris from the flood stood 5 feet high, a stinking, oily mass of furniture, broken globes, books, clothing.
I managed to save a couple of moulds, said Ulysses.
Well, that's plastic for you, said Des. Indestructible.
It's calamitous, said Pete. They clear the mud, and more appears.
Sisyphean, said Des. But people are tenacious. If evolution has taught us anything...
Thousands of homeless already, said Ulysses. Many of them old. The keepers of history, said Pete. All those craftsmen gone.
Changes things, doesn't it? Said Des. Soul of the community goes. You boys need any money?
Nah. We're good, thanks, Des. Cress had another little moment.
What was it this time?
World Cup, said Pete. Not only to win, but...
The Jeffhurst hat trick, said Des.
The two men nodded.
Man of vision, said Des.
And at that moment, the man of vision himself appeared. Brand new waders up to his armpits, bright eyes, mouth quivering with anticipation. Clearly, Cress had something important to say.
I've got something important to say, he said. We can flush the toilets again.
Small mercy, said Pete.
And,
said Cress, and he gestured for them to follow. They stood on the bank of the river, back to its normal level, but full of crap, a right old junkyard in which people had tossed wrecked cars and mattresses. But that wasn't what Cress wanted them to see.
Look, he said, over there.
A long procession of heavy trucks entering the city, each one loaded with a crane or a tractor or a generator, and cheers went up around them. The rumbling sound and heavy clank as the first of the wrecked cars was towed away. Night rolled in cold and sharp. Cress sitting at the dining table, surrounded by candles and students, holding court.
I would actually call it a small miracolo, he said.
the Moto Guzzi was thrown clear of the tumult by the first surge of water, landed on the steps, ergo protecting it from the onslaught of oil and muck that was to follow. Now, you tell me why.
God's a motorcycle enthusiast, said Ulysses, collecting the plates. Massimo was by the window, watching Cress and the students. He said,
Alice, who's the young man in the green jumper?
That's Jem. He arrived a few days ago. He's lovely. I've been working with him at the library. You want me to introduce you?
No. Go on then. Yes.
No, Alice, no, I... Jem? Jem looked up from the table and smiled. Alice waved him over. This is Massimo. Massimo? Jem. On the sofa, the elderly Contessa was staring at Claude, and Claude was staring at her, first one to blink. In the doorway, Pete and Des. Des was heading back the following day for a conference on the sustainability of plastic and was even taking one of the tar-soaked moulds with him. Pete, though, had decided to stay.
Do you mind, Des? Said Pete.
Do I mind? Course I don't. If I wasn't a keynote speaker, I'd be staying on myself. But I'll miss your company in the cockpit, I can tell you that for nothing.
Temps!
Ulysses came out of the kitchen. You okay, Pete?
I've been thinking, Temps. I'm not going home. Not with Des. Not ever. How does that sound?
Sounds really good to me, Pete. How's it sound to you?
Bit daft, if I'm totally honest. I've no idea what I'm going to do.
You'll do what you've always done, said Ulysses, glancing at the piano. Pete huddled low, fingers dexterous across the keys, fag smoke bothering his bloodshot eyes.
This song's called Angeli del Fango, he said. Mud Angels.
It was a ballad about the young men and women who'd come to the city, about good rising out of need, about love in all its forms, about kindness and looking out for one another. And only the third verse was about art, but even that was about the paradox of meaning. It was classic Pete. Took you one way, took you back, then delivered the punch. He leant back from the keys and cracked his knuckles. The soft waft of dope inched in from the terrace.
Hello, hello. Marrakesh all over again, he said.
So that was it. Early to bed. The students switched on their torches and went down the stairs to the pensione to sleep. Des called it a night too, handed Ulysses an envelope and asked him to give it to Michele and Julia.
Is this what I think it is? Said Ulysses.
You think right, said Des. Money for a new kitchen and anything else they need. Note inside explains it all. If I can't do it for people in need, what's the point of being rich? Night, lad. See you in the morning, Des. That left only Jem by the bookshelf, head down reading. In his hands a burgundy, cloth-covered book. He looked up and quoted. Old women light the porte-cochere, shut the grills with thorough care, and with that same maternal light they close the city for the night. But like a child, unkeen to sleep, the city rises from the deep. Massimo clapped, a little too enthusiastically.
Everything by Constance Everly, said Cress.
Yes, said Jem, and he held up the poetry collection. I bought the book Nothing for my old art teacher, Evelyn Skinner. She and Constance were great friends. That's one of the reasons why I'm here, I suppose. Because of Evelyn. Anyway, he said, it's late, and I'm talking to...
Oh, no,
said Alice. Stay where you are, Jem Gunnerslake.
Constance Everly, said Cress.
Evelyn Skinner, said Ulysses. Yes, said Jem.
I think you need to sit back down and tell us all you know, said Cress.
Massimo fetched a bottle of Amaro, and Jem duly did. Now, 1,000 miles away, Evelyn Skinner was sitting in her flat in Bloomsbury, leg up on a stool, with her right ankle wrapped in ice. Her ears had been burning for the last 24 hours, although she didn't think the two afflictions were linked. She'd been following stories of the flood avidly, maybe a little too avidly, because it made her distracted, and a few days ago, climbing out of the Kenwood Ladies' Pond in Hampstead, she'd slipped. It was a silly sprain, that's all, and had caused huge merriment at the time on account of her suddenly finding out at the age of 86 she could do the splits. The prescription was to rest up and follow the medical advice. Sunday afternoon, and Dottie handed her a large G&T. "To be taken with a painkiller," said Dottie. "Oh, and here," she added, suddenly remembering the newspaper. "Florence floods are on page 5, she said, handing the Observer to Evelyn. Evelyn read out loud.
"Florence struggles to save its past. Well, it's always done that." "Oh, God, no. Cimabue's crucifix, unsalvageable, they say."
"Is that significant?"
"Oh, gosh, yes, it really is, Dottie. A salutary link between the Byzantine and the Renaissance. Without Cimabue, there wouldn't have been Giotto."
"And without Giotto," said Dottie,
"we may as well have called it a day."
Evelyn looked down and continued to read out loud. She said,
"Army are using flamethrowers to dispose of horse carcasses. Del Sarto's Last Supper in San Salvi has succumbed. Prisoners from the Murate were released temporarily and now they've escaped." "Well, you would, wouldn't you?" said Dottie. "Hardly news. And frogmen have gone into the sewers to clear them."
"Deserve a king's ransom for that," said Dottie.
"Professor Carlo Raggianti, and I quote," said Evelyn, "believes help from abroad for stricken Florence will do more than anything to revive the spirit of its citizens for the long struggle which lies ahead."
Dottie stood up and said, "Fancy some olives?"
"Why not?" said Evelyn,
and she turned the page. And as soon as she had, she cried out Dottie's name. Dottie rushed back in. "What is it, darling?" Evelyn handed the newspaper to Dottie. A photograph of a man, waist-height in the floodwaters of Florence, holding aloft a large globe. The caption read, "Atlas, rising from the flood."
"It's not Atlas," said Evelyn, shaking. "It's..."
"Your soldier, isn't it?" Evelyn nodded.
"I found him, Dottie,"